who sends her greetings to you. Sorry she can't be with you this weekend. Doing a lot of travelling. It's just not working out for us to travel as a family every weekend, flying around the country. But if we could have the next slide, please. Oh, I've got this thing, haven't I? We don't use these in Burkina Faso. So this is our family. There's my wife, Lynn, and our daughter, Isla. There's two of Isla's best friends, Andy and Raisha. And we had Emma and Debbie come out to help homeschool Isla and help with some admin work in the office. In the middle is Talata. She's a local girl who's orphaned, and she's just been living with us as part of our family. Down the bottom, Isla's got about 30 chickens and about 12 rabbits and 3 sheep and a goat, and there's a what else? There's 3 cats and a cow and goodness knows what else. That's all part of our family. And then that's me in hospital in Ouagadougou. Just in December, I had a heart attack while I was out there, which was really interesting. I ended up in the National Hospital in Ouagadougou, and you know, it wasn't comfortable. You know, it's not like what we're used to here. And I know that, you know, our NHS has its problems. But, you know, there were no toilets. There's no running water. There's no people to get your medicines and tests for you. So my wife had to sleep on the concrete floor next to me. And she was the one who had to go and get, you know, buy the medicines and get those blood tests and bring my food. And you pay for everything, of course. And, you know, we could afford to do that. And then with medical insurance, we got evacuated. But surrounding me were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who didn't have those options, you know, who struggled to pay the £1 a day for their bed. We saw this one guy sat outside on the concrete, still with tubes in his coming out, because he'd been thrown out because he couldn't pay for his bed. And a guy with one leg in the queue to buy his medicines because he hasn't got anyone to buy it for him, and he hasn't got the money, the £1 to buy his medicines. And it's just overwhelming seeing this swathe of humanity, and just a reminder. You know, we all get so into our worlds, don't we? And we can be doing lots of good stuff, but we forget that there's a huge world out there in such dire need. And we've all got our own needs and our own problems, but it was really good to be there and to see again the vast need that is there, the thousands of people in need of God's love. There we go. So we're working, I've been 29 years in Burkina Faso now, and the main heart of everything we're doing is reaching unreached Muslim peoples with the good news of Jesus, and particularly these 3 people groups, the Fulani, who were the people who brought Islam into West Africa and spread it through West Africa. They're the cattle herders. The Tamashek, who are the desert nomads who cross the desert on their camels, blue men of the desert. And then the Sonrai, who are a Muslim people who mix their Islam with sorcery. And so 3 very distinct people groups, and these are the people that God has led us to. Because Jesus, his vision and his plan, the plan of God from before the foundation of the world, when God knew the man was going to fall into sin, God planned a mission, which was that all nations should receive the blessing of Abraham, should receive the blessing of salvation, and that around the throne on that last day, there will be people of every tribe, nation, people and tongue gathered together to worship Jesus. And yet 2,000 years ago, to our shame, that job still has not been done. There's still millions, if you look at the Muslim world, there's hundreds of millions of people who have no knowledge of the good news of Jesus. And yet that is our job. That's the one job God left us when Jesus went back to heaven. He passed the baton to us to take the gospel to all nations. And so that's what we're about. For the first 20 years of my ministry with these people, I worked in this province. Oh, bother. So in this province in the northeast here called Oudalan province. And it's about the size, if you can imagine, of Northamptonshire, Cambridgeshire, Leicestershire and Warwickshire all together, and there wasn't a single Christian in that area. And I don't know if you can just imagine that for a moment, that, you know, here you are in Brixworth, a small town, there's this many of you. In that whole area, not a single Christian, all completely Muslim. And so I went there and I was spent the first few years learning the language and praying and trying to think about how to reach the Muslims with the good news of Jesus. Because you know that all the stuff we hear a bit about Islam. And yet, as I lived there, we discovered that Muslims want to know about Jesus. And we would go out and I would go out and sit under trees and talk to Fulani about Jesus. And I would wander around the town and... we discovered that, as you probably know, Muslims know Jesus from the Quran. The Quran says that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary. He was the Messiah. He was sinless. He did miracles. He was the Spirit of God. He's the Word of God. He ascended alive into heaven and he's coming again. The Quran talks about Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham and a lot of the people who are in our Bible. And so we began building, just like Peter when he went to Cornelius. He says, you know this about Jesus. And then he led him from there to the good news of salvation. So that's the approach that we took. And we discovered that Muslims want to know. They know there's a day of judgment. They know they need forgiveness to be able to stand before God on that day. And we have good news for them. And so you can see me on the right there in the mosque. We regularly get invited into the mosques to share the good news of Jesus. Now, I'm not a brilliant evangelist. I'm not an extrovert. I'm an introvert. I find it really hard doing this stuff. And so I battled on. But after 5 years, we had about 5 Christians. After 10 years, we had about 10 Christians. After 15 years, we had about 15 Christians. And so I'm obviously not very good at the job. But God faithfully took even an ass like me and, you know, was bringing people to know him. Suddenly, after 20 years, we had about 80 Christians. And today, there's about 120 Christians in the province from those 3 people groups. And then in 2012, we got evacuated from Udaland. So this is the current map of Burkina, according to the British government. And the yellow bit you see, it says, the government advises against all but essential travel, and the red bit is advice you just don't go there. And that's where we were working, right in the north, right near the border with Mali. And over the past few years, there had been Al-Qaeda been active in Mali. And then in 2012, Lynn and I were in a prayer meeting one evening, and a pastor came and said, the police need you. I said, okay, we'll finish the prayer meeting. Then we'll go. He says, no, you need to go now. They've already got your daughter. Her daughter was staying at home with friends. And they've gone and collected your daughter. You need to go now. And so they took us out and we had a midnight drive under armed guard down to the big town and then all the way down to the capital. And they told us Al-Qaeda had come in with my name and my phone number and my address and come in to kidnap us that night. And so they'd come to rescue us and take us out, which obviously was a bit of a shock. 10 minutes after 20 years and we were taken out of there. And then 2 big questions. Okay, where do we go now? And what's going to happen to all this that we've been doing for the last 20 years? So God led us to Kaya, and by God's grace, you know, we've been able to start a new ministry there in the prison with the street boys, with the Fulani villages and doing the dental work. But what about Udaland? What about what's going to happen there after 20 years? Well, God's a faithful God, and what the enemy plans for evil, God turns to good. And these are my heroes of the faith. I understand you've been looking at heroes of the faith. These guys' names should be written in Hebrews 11. They're the guys I've been working with over the last few years. And when we were evacuated, they just stepped up to the mark and they took the work forward. Pascal is probably the godliest man I've ever met or known, a real man of vision and faith and prayer. Sado, a very hands-on man. We've trained him to do well repair, and he goes and he repairs wells in villages, restoring water, and brings the gospel. Pierre is a converted Muslim himself, and he goes regularly into the mosques and has a specific ministry towards the Islamic teachers. And these guys have picked up the work and are carrying the work forward, preaching the gospel going into villages, doing evangelism, planting churches. Churches often like that, just in simple shelters, people sitting on the ground, and supporting pastors. Now about 15 pastors in the province, and these guys are pastors to those pastors in the remotest parts of the country. And through them, the church has come to birth, and there's, like I say, about 120. Once every 2 years, we do a conference called the Together for Udaland Conference. And the vision of Together for Udaland is to bring together everyone who has a vision for this conference, whether it be the pastors, the local Christians, people like ourselves who love the work there, some churches in the UK and the US, and we all get together and we strategize and pray about how can we impact this whole province, see that whole province transformed for Jesus. So there's Pascal, Pierre and Saidu, and now these three guys, Alay, Sambo and Hamidou, they're three of the Muslim converts who are now themselves evangelists and church planters and pastors. Alay used to give the call to prayer at the mosque. Sambo is an orphan who's now become basically a cross-cultural missionary planting a church amongst another people group. But he's also one of the people Lynn's trained to be a dentist. And Hamidou is also planting a church in another Fulani village. So they become leaders. And then the people they're ministering to is some of these guys up the top. These are some of the leaders, the emerging leaders in the province. Some of them leading churches in their village without even having any knowledge of the scriptures. And so learning the stories of the gospel and then sharing that. And so you see a generational thing. Pascal, Pierre and Saidu training up Alay, Sambu and Hamidou, who are inputting into these guys who are then leading their churches. And that's what the vision is about. It's not about the white missionary going in there. It's about seeing a church that's founded, growing out of the ground of Udaland in a Fulani, Tamashek, Somrai culture and language that's led by them and is their flavour and shape. Another thing that is very much on our heart in all that we do and that Pascal, Pierre and Saidu have as part of their ministry is just bringing the love of God in practical ways to those communities. So Saidu does his well repair, the poverty relief, wherever a pastor says, look, we've got this need in our village, we see if we can get behind them. Rebuilding homes after a flood, or this was a village where they had a water hole that they used for market gardening and it had fallen into disrepair and it wasn't working anymore. Saidu was planting a church in that village and we managed to repair that water hole and more than triple their food production in that village. Of course, that's a tremendous testimony, and so the church is now coming to birth in that village. We started a Christian school in Gorum Gorum, which is now one of, if not the best school in the north of Burkina. And we get Muslims lining up now to put their kids into that school, and kids are becoming Christians and are getting a good quality education that is preparing them for their future. And then there's the dental work. So as you saw, Lynn, she would go out into villages and just set up under a tree. In Burkina, there's one dentist for every 300,000 people. And of course, those dentists are in the big cities, you know, for the middle class, the people with money. So the people in villages have no access to any dental care, and there's many people there with dental pain for years. And so we go out and they set up under a tree, and we do evangelism first, and then they do the dental work. And they can have dozens and dozens of people coming. So Lynn then has been training up these four people, Sambu, Sophie, Grass and Rosine. And they've just this year graduated. So after 3 years training, many of them who have not even finished primary school schooling, but are able to do dental work and extraction better than most dentists. And they are now going themselves, without Lynn being there, into villages in the name of Jesus. Just yesterday we had a message from them saying, we're in this village and, you know, not many people came because it was our first time there, but eight people came and they're very thankful. They gave money to say thank you, and people are becoming Christians through it. And this is Sambo, who, again, he's the best of them. He's helping really to train the other dentists now. And as a Fulani himself, We focus on going to the unreached villages, and we went into this one village and met this young lady who was a Fulani Christian. And she didn't know there was another Fulani Christian. She thought she was the only Fulani Christian in the world. And she said, "Is there a Fulani Bible?" And Sambo said, "Here's mine." And that's her holding his Fulani New Testament. We don't have the whole Bible yet. So it's great to see the gospel going into these places in practical ways. And very quickly, just want to share this with you. In the north of Burkina, with Al-Qaeda there in Mali and coming into Burkina Faso, the United Nations said in a recent report that most of the young people who get involved in Al-Qaeda and these terrorist groups in Africa, they know nothing about the philosophy of these groups and are not sympathetic to it. The main thing in their lives at the time they get involved in these groups is that they're looking for a job. Because they have no education, no job prospects, no money. And then Al-Qaeda comes and offers them a couple of £1,000 to come and join them, which will look after their family. And so the United Nations was saying, it's so key that we reach these young people in these vulnerable areas of Africa. And that is what one of the things Pascal is doing. He started this youth outreach centre where they've got sports, we've got a basketball and volleyball, and we've helped him build a study centre where people come to study and run. This is training in entrepreneuria where young men and women can come and learn how to start businesses. And so we really want to get behind him and to develop that and start a library and a skill training centre, which will not only change people's lives, not only offer them the good news of Jesus, which gives them a different future, but also suck them away from that the temptation to be drawn into those extremist groups in the north of Burkina and over into Mali. So this is that conference that we do once every couple of years. So, you know, if you want to get involved in what we're doing, this would be a great thing for you to do. So because it's so strategic in terms of the ministry of these three guys, Pascal, Seydou and Pierre, into Oudaland, they are effectively reaching Muslims. And we know that the Muslim world is a vast unreached area, but they are seeing Muslims come to Christ, they're seeing churches planted, they're seeing those converts move into ministry themselves. They're serving the poorest of the poor. The north of Burkina is one of the poorest parts of the whole world, and they're effectively combating terrorism by taking away those things that radical extremism feeds on. So, do feel free, if you want to know more, to come and see me. There's a sign-up sheet at the back there. You can connect with me on Facebook. That's how we get our news out most regularly, that people follow us day by day as things happen, as people become Christians, as people face challenges. Seydou, just this week, his wife has been taken into hospital, and we've got hundreds of people around the world praying for him because they've read that news on Facebook. So do come and see me if you want to get our newsletter. And I'm probably overrunning my time, so we ought to go on to the scriptures. You've gone very quiet.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah, is that all right? As you can see, Burkina Faso is a little bit different from Brixworth. And yet... if there's one thing I want us to grasp today is that, you know, what we're doing there is no different from what you're doing here. Jesus, when he calls us to himself, he calls us to join in his mission. Come and follow me and I will make you fishers of men. That we might change this world for Jesus. And, you know, we look around us and, you know, the nice homes and the nice lives that people have around us. And yet behind those front doors, okay, they might not have problems with, you know, to get clean water or to pay the money for their kids' school fees or to pay their medicines because we've got the NHS. But there's all kinds of stuff going on behind people's front doors. There's broken marriages, there's addictions, there's loneliness, there's sickness that is just destroying people's lives, and the sin that people need the hope of forgiveness and the hope of freedom. And God has put you here to bring that good news. Amen. So Today we're going to look at the multitudes, and I'm going to read the story. You know it really well. From just a bit of background, you know that Jesus, it's really interesting when Jesus comes off the mountain, you know, he's done the Sermon on the Mount and comes down off the mountain. It's really interesting. Up till that point, the focus has been on the temple. You know, the nations come to Jerusalem to go to the temple, you know, to get the blessing of the living God. And from when Jesus comes, the focus changes completely. No more about the temple, but it's about the nations. And even when the disciples are there saying, look how wonderful this temple is, Jesus says, this temple is going to be destroyed. But the gospel must be preached in all nations as a testimony, and then the end will come. And so Jesus is all about that mission of the Father to bring the good news to the ends of the earth. And as he comes down off the mountain, you see him going out, specifically targeting the people who don't have access to the temple, the unclean, the leper, and the woman with the issue of blood, and the dead child, the man full of demons in a pagan country. And he's specifically always going out, no longer people having to go to the temple to get the blessing of God, but taking the kingdom of God and taking it out to the unclean and changing people's lives by the power of God that is in him. He's good shepherd who's always going out looking for the lost sheep. When Peter's looking for him, he says, everyone's looking for you. What are you doing here praying in the bush here? And Jesus says, I've got to go to other villages as well. That's why I've come. He's always going out looking for the lost to bring them to the Father's heart. And he invites us into that mission. And when you see him calling the disciples, he calls them to join him in that mission. And bit by bit, as you go through the scriptures, you see him beginning to give them jobs in this mission and sending them out and involving them in his ministry and training them for mission. And then John the Baptist gets beheaded. Jesus' cousin gets beheaded. And so Jesus at this time he's going through a lot of personal angst and pain. And then the disciples go and bury John the Baptist. And then it says, the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they'd done and taught. And then, because so many people were coming and going, they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they're busy, they're tired, they haven't eaten, they haven't had time for rest. And some of us are in that place, aren't we? Some of us have got pain about stuff that's going on in our lives. Some of us are tired and weary. We've been serving God for ages. And sometimes Jesus calls us aside and so that we can just have time with him. We need that. We need that time with him. But what happens? So they went by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. And when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them. And some of the other writers say he began healing them as well. When I was in that hospital, and you know, it would be very easy to become consumed with my own problems at that point. I was tired. I was, you know, in a bit of discomfort from the heart attack. I didn't really know what was going on. But Jesus again turned my eyes to see that those around us. And I don't know what you're going through, but wherever it is, you know, sometimes even in the midst of that pain, even in the midst of that tiredness, Jesus wants us to turn our eyes again to see that actually there's a swathe of humanity, there's a multitude out there whose needs, whose hunger, whose desperate need of the touch of God is way, way beyond ours. And he wants us to turn our eyes again and to look with compassion. You know, sometimes we have a busy day, and you know what it's like sometimes. I mean, we might have been out in the village doing evangelism and dental work, or in the prison, and then we come home and we're tired and we just want to flop into bed or into the chair. And then we get home And there's a crowd of people on our front doorstep, and there's maybe people with dental pain, or sometimes we've had people, you know, with pus oozing out of holes in their face, and people with great big, you know, infections in, and you just, or people who just want to, you know, have come to see us, or people who want to know about Jesus, and you just think, as I imagine, maybe I would have been if I'd have been in Jesus' place. Oh, come on! You know, don't you know that I'm tired? And I get like that, perhaps you do sometimes, when, you know, you're tired and run down and someone comes again, you go, oh, come on, give us a break. My wife is frustratingly compassionate, and I love it about her. It's Jesus in her. So we come home like this, and we're drooping, and immediately Lynn just looks at these people with compassion, and she can't turn anyone away, and she does operations on our front doorstep, and, you know, just healing and saving lives, and pouring herself into the lives of these people who come to our home. And that's the compassion of Jesus. That's the compassion of God. As God looks at the world, he looks with compassion. And when you look at the world with the compassion of God, it changes everything. When those people who are annoying, when those people who are interrupting our plans and agendas, and when we're tired, when they come, when you look at them with compassion, the compassion of God, not our compassion, but you feel that compassion of God that looks at them and you see them as God sees them, that changes everything. It changes the way you're going to plan your time. It changes when you look at... I was asking, are there any food banks here? Or, you know, is there a lot of poverty? Are there a lot of immigrants? And I was told there's not particularly here in Brixworth, but you go to Northampton and there's someone was saying you hardly hear English. Or you hardly hear an English accent, I think he said. But how do you look at those people? Do you think, oh, more immigrants? Why don't they go back to where they come from? You know, it changes the way you talk about people, because once compassion is in you and you look at people with the compassion of God and you feel God's heart for them, you know that our program for these people is not the same as any government's program. Our program is to reach them with the love of God. It changes the way you look at Muslims. It changes the way you look at that homeless person that you walk past on the street. It changes the way you look at the news and you respond and react to the news and about the refugees, about the problems, because you're not reacting just from some political perspective or some personal perspective, but that compassion of God that's wanting to reach these people and has even brought these people to us so that we can show them God's love. And that compassion moves you. It says Jesus was moved with compassion, and so he began to teach and heal. And that compassion will not allow you to just watch and say, oh, isn't that terrible, and then switch over to watch Britain's Got Talent. It will move you to say, God, what can we do about this? And so Jesus is there. He's moved with compassion. He's teaching them. And I know a lot of you are in this. You know, I've heard such great things about what you as a church are doing, and you know, you might be, you know, you've got the TNT, you've got the mothers and toddlers, you've got the coffee thing, you've got so many things that you're involved in. You might think, we can't do more. We can't do more. What can we do? But it's interesting, Peter, by this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him and they say, this is a remote place. It's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat. And I can imagine Peter, you know, he's been learning with Jesus, so, you know, he's probably thought, you know, he's got a bit of that compassion. I've seen the suffering of these people, Jesus. You know, you need to do something. Let them go and find something to eat. And he's praying. And that's often our first reaction, isn't it? We see the need, we hear the news about the poor and the Muslims and the unreached, and our first reaction is, Jesus, do something. Do something for this multitude, Jesus. And Jesus says, you do something about it. You feed them. Because that's our job. And of course we look at that and we say, I think Peter must have been outraged, to be honest. I mean, they haven't even eaten. They came to this place because they were hungry and tired. They haven't eaten, and they were looking for some rest. Now, they've been busy with Jesus all day with these crowds. And then Jesus says, feed these people. We haven't even eaten ourselves yet. I think Peter must have been outraged. And anyway, this huge number of people, how are we going to be able to feed them? And we look at this, the vast challenge beyond before us of the Muslim world, the unreached nations, the poverty, the immigrants, and we say, we can't. How can we do that? And anyway, we're so busy with what we're doing, we're tired, and you know. And it's dangerous to pray. So when I first went to Burkina Faso, we went to this town, Gorum, and I saw the huge need there, and I started praying, God, send someone to Gorum to work amongst the Fulani, to learn their language and live with them and share the gospel. And there was this couple working with us called Alan and Judy. I said, God, send Alan and Judy to Gorum. One day on a bus, God spoke to me and said, okay, I'll send someone. But it's not Alan and Judy. And he put his finger on me. And he said, it's a dangerous thing to pray. Because often God will want you to be the answer to the prayer that you're praying. When Jesus turns the eyes of his disciples again to the harvest fields and he says, look to the harvest fields. They're white, they're ready. Amongst the Muslim world today, Jesus is revealing himself in dreams and visions. There are people with a hunger for God. The fastest growing churches in the world today are in Afghanistan and Iran. There's a harvest field out there. It's the workers that are few. And Jesus says, so pray for laborers to go out into the harvest field. And what's his next word? Go. Because once you start praying, it's dangerous because God will say, okay, you've seen, you've got that compassion. Right, you go and feed these people. And we say, I can't. Who am I? So, they say to him that would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread? Are we to give it to them? And then Jesus says, how many loaves do you have? He asked, go and see. And when they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. So here they come with the 5 loaves and 2 fish. And we may look at at what we've got in our hands and say, well, you know, because Jesus tells us, what do you have? Moses, what's that in your hand? It's a stick. But that stick, which can do nothing apart from, I don't know, but that stick in the hand of the man of God, under the anointing of God, opened the Red Sea and set God's people free. And that stick can do nothing of its own, but it's that stick brought to God that can set God's people free. It's that 5 loaves and 2 fish that, I mean, if the disciples divided that between just themselves, you know, send the people away, we'll have this 5 loaves and 2 fish, they'll get a little bit each like that. And one of the other writers says, you know, Jesus tells them to do this, and it says he knew what he was going to do. Really interesting. We'll come back to that later. So Jesus is asking us today, well, okay, what do you have? So what do you have? It's good practice, and I do it regularly, either to actually mentally go through the list or even write down what you've got. So, you know, I've got a house. Probably the single biggest underused resource in the kingdom of God are houses. It's interesting to see how Jesus used houses, how God uses houses in the scriptures. I've got a house, maybe I've got a car, I've got some money, I've got health, I've got some strength, I've got some knowledge, I've got some abilities, I've got a family. And just go through, write it all down. What have you got? And then Jesus says, bring it to me. Because all that stuff is just a stick. That stuff can't save the world. It's never going to be enough. That 5 loaves and 2 fish can never feed that huge crowd. But brought to Jesus, because Jesus knows what he's going to do with it. That can feed the multitude. That stick can set God's people free. And, you know, we need to feel that inadequacy. We need to have that sense that we can't do it. Moses, you know, when he had the vision for setting God's people free and he went to do it in his own strength, he ended up running into the desert for 40 years. And then when finally God called him and said, okay, now I'm going to use you to set God's people free, he says, I can't do it. Now you're ready. We have to be at that place where we know all we've got is a stick, all we've got is 5 loaves and 2 fish, and it just is not enough. But brought to Jesus, Jesus can change the world with that. And so Jesus says, what have you got? And it's good. Go back and look. You know, look at your what your money you've got, and just your home, your car, your family, your abilities, and lay it on the altar before Jesus. And say, Jesus, this is what I've got. Here's my loaves and two fish. Take it and use it for you. Because Jesus, you know the parable of the stewards, where it says the king gives his money to his stewards, and one day he's going to come back and ask them what they've done with it, and look for at least interest, look for what they've produced with that. And all that we've got, Jesus, it's not ours, it's Jesus's. And one day he's going to come back, he's going to say, what have you produced with it? And so we need to bring that to Jesus, because it's just not enough. And give it to Jesus and see what he wants to do with it. I just want to say that from this. I'm not after your money. I don't want you me coming up after giving me your money. This is about giving it first to God. And then God will direct what to do with it, how to make the people sit down and feed the crowds with it. And just to give a little bit of perspective, because, you know, life is difficult for everyone these days. I read a couple of weeks ago that the average wage in the UK is just under £28,000 a year, average salary. And in terms of the world, if you're getting £28,000 a year, that puts you in the top 1% of the richest people in the world. And that's just to give you a little perspective on, you know, what we have. We may think of it, it's just very small, and it's not certainly not going to be enough, but it's more than we think that we've got. So, and then what happens? So, Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups. They sat down in groups, taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish and looking up to heaven. He gives thanks, blesses the food, and broke the loaves. And then he gives it back to his disciples to distribute to the people. So Jesus knew what he was going to do. He knew that when this was brought to him, he could bless the thing, give it back to the disciples, and again put them into the work. It's them who are going to feed the people. And of course, it says, they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties, taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and blah, blah, done that bit. He divided the 2 fish amongst them. They all ate and were satisfied. They all ate and were satisfied. So the 5 loaves and 2 fish that you've got, God can use that to fulfill his purpose and to feed the multitudes, to set the people free. God can even take someone like me to build his church amongst unreached people groups in West Africa. That is phenomenal. You know, when I look back, I'm not a great preacher, I'm not a great evangelist, I'm not a great at anything. But when we just bring it and say, God, here it is, this is what I have, use it. It is enough, and people will be satisfied. But really interesting what happens next. It's kind of an addendum, a follow-on. And it says, and the disciples picked up, how many baskets? 12. 12 baskets. That means they had a whole basket full each of food. And this is my testimony, you know. I went out, spent 20 years out there on my own as a single guy. You know, I went out with everything I owned, you know. I went out with my backpack and my guitar. And, you know, after 15 years was seeing very little fruit. And, you know, I thought, you know, my friends and my brothers, you know, they'd all got married and got wives and kids and houses and cars. And I was there out in the, on the edge of the desert in a mud hut, sweating and with nothing in the world and with almost no fruit to show for it. And I was thinking, you know, am I just wasting my time? Am I just kidding myself? And yet here I am, you know, a few more years later, and we've got the church growing amongst the unreached people. I've got the most amazing wife, lovely little daughter. We've even got a home in Scotland that we can come back to. If the disciples had just kept that five loaves and two fish, they would have just had that little bit each. Now they've got a basket full each. They can't even eat all of that. It's an abundance. It's a, you know, the cup running over, isn't it? And that's the promise of Jesus, is that, you know, when we go to make disciples of all nations, he will be with us. He will never abandon us. The disciples at one point, when Jesus said to the rich man, it's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. The disciples said, what about us? We've left everything to follow you. And Jesus said, I tell you the truth, if you've left whatever it is, homes and families and mums and dads and kids and farms, and you'll receive 100 times as much in this world. And in the age to come, you'll have eternal life. We can't lose. That's the promise of Jesus. That's the picture that we see here. And I have hundreds of homes. I have hundreds of mothers and fathers. When I was in hospital, the doctors were getting annoyed because we had so many people coming to visit. From hundreds of miles away, they would come and visit us in the hospital. And it blew my mind. Because I've got brothers and sisters and homes and families all over Burkina Faso. Jesus will never abandon us. But we have to go through the suffering and the sacrifice of bringing everything to Jesus and allowing him to do what he wants with it in order to find that. And when we get that, that's not for us to then store up and say, oh, it's not some prosperity gospel where we become rich. He gives us that so that we can invest it again. That compassion moves us to invest that again into his kingdom. So, just to finish, you'll be glad to know, I just want to encourage us to look first of all with compassion, to turn our eyes and say, God, help me to see again the multitudes with your compassion. And then to begin praying, being aware how dangerous that is, and to say, God, here am I, and here is what I have. Here's, take it, use me, use my life for your kingdom. And maybe, you know, I don't know you guys, I don't know what you're going through, I don't know the pain of your lives, I don't know, you know, maybe you've never come to Jesus, but I just want to say Jesus makes everything better. And you may hesitate about bringing your life and giving it to Jesus because of fear, or because you feel you're not worthy, or because you're suspicious, or you've seen the hypocrisy in other Christians. And all that Jesus understands, but Jesus makes everything better. And he will make your life better, but he will also make your life a means to make other people's lives better. Because he's called us to him in order that he might bring his love into this world. And that's his plan for Burkina Faso and for Brixworth. Thank you.
I think we've got a couple of songs to close. Maybe